Welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Nicole Flattery. The Stinging Fly has been publishing new writers and new writing for the past 28 years. We take a particular interest in promoting the short story, and for this podcast, we asked writers from the latest issue of the Stinging Fly magazine to join us in the studio and discuss their work. On this month's episode, I'm joined by magazine editor Lisa McInerney and our former nonfiction editor Roisin Kybert to discuss the process of putting together the latest issue of the Stinging Fly. Taking the climate emergency as its theme, the Stinging Fly issue 53 offers a variety of responses to the impending climate catastrophe and our responsibility to the current political moment, exploring the ways in which our world is changing and, for better or worse, our role in that change. Welcome, Lisa and Roisin.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
I was really smiling a lot there when I said climate catastrophe.
I think that's all we can do at this point. It's just
grin and bear it.
Yeah.
That's not our official advice, is it?
No. Something more hopeful.
That's what we want you to come away from this issue.
Literature as distraction from climate emergency.
So, we've had to cancel this podcast because of the rain.
Three times, right?
Yeah. I can't keep talking about the weather, but yet I can't talk about anything else. So,
I mean, the fact that the climate specific podcast was waylaid by climate, I think is very appropriate. I think I'm happy about it, actually.
I feel, obviously, you both teach in Galway, but I feel like people are more responsive to talking about the weather in Galway. I feel like when you're in Galway, you can talk to anyone about the weather. But in Dublin, everyone is just like, no.
Is this the thing? Because I just figured all Irish people do is talk about weather. But I've never lived in Dublin.
Yeah, I don't think people are as open to talking about the rain.
Roisin, really? Is this true as a Dubliner?
Maybe I'm approaching them the wrong way.
There's a lot of things that would be like categorized as small talk that I think I've actually been failing to understand like all my life. So that's one of those things I think about. But if someone does talk about the weather, I mean, I take it seriously because the weather is an event at the moment. Like the weather is a presence in my life. It's like, it's the chicken of despair that's on my windowsill and it won't leave and it's oppressive. And I genuinely was looking at sad lamps last night.
I know.
On the internet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I went and bought a vitamin D supplement. I was like, I can't.
Apparently we should all be taking them.
No, do you feel happy?
I wouldn't say happy, Roisin.
Will it help? Like, I'm drinking CBD tea. I've resorted to that.
Yeah. It's just terrible the effect it has on your mood. Like, I am feeling it like, you know, I'm not getting enjoyment from just like even walking around. Well, obviously you can walk around, but I get a lot of pleasure from just walking around.
I know.
And seeing what's going on.
Your career as a flanus has been, again, waylaid by climate.
Well, when you're wading through floods, I know what you mean. Like, I had a moment a few days ago where I laughed out loud at something I heard on the podcast, and then I realized I just hadn't laughed in ages.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I know. It's dark. It's dark.
Like, as a Galwegian, there's a bit of me that's kind of going, well, I'm glad now you're finally seeing what it's like.
Because it is standard. Like, I remember one January I was in Galway and it rained every day of the January. I remember just being like,
this is just it. And it's very irritating, actually, when people say to you, well, there's no bad weather. There's just bad clothing.
Oh,
and you're like, no, there's bad weather.
Shut up.
Yeah, my mother says that to me. Oh, no. And I'm like, you live in, there is bad weather.
Mammy Flattery, if you're listening, stop that now.
She's not missing.
And that's when the podcast turned into a complaint about people's mothers.
That's all done.
Group therapy session.
So tell me all about this issue, how it came about. How did you decide you were going to do a climate issue?
I'm trying to remember. It's been something that's been on the cards for so long. It's been something we've been talking about at the Stinging Fly for ages. We don't do themed issues very often, but it is something we've been putting together our climate policy, and we've been thinking more about like where we fit in terms of the practical things that we can do ourselves just as a team. And then also like, well, you know, when you start thinking about that, you start thinking about, well, what can writing do about this? How does it respond to it? So I suppose that the idea of doing an issue made a lot of sense in that context. So it's been on the cards for ages. And then we finally just put it in the calendar and said, okay, we've got to do this.
Yeah.
We have to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we did.
Yeah, and you did.
And here it is. That's all I have to say.
Well, it's a great issue. Can you talk about, Roisin, picking the nonfiction pieces for this issue and what you were looking for?
Yeah, it was, just for starters, it was a different process to usual. Mm-hmm. We accepted proposals, like pitches, okay, rather than the finished pieces. So completely different. It looked much simpler than it was going to be from the start. Yeah. A deceptively simple task. Mm. You know, reading 200 or so pitches is a lot easier than reading 200 or so essays. But then you're ending up with a process where the finished piece, when it comes in, might not look anything like the pitch. And I relate to that pretty intensely. Like, my own pitches are sort of half-baked, ridiculous. Like, I don't know. Someone, Mark O'Connell, I remember, on this podcast years ago, once said that my pieces must be hard to pitch. And I loved that because I was like,
that's,
oh, you get it.
That's a real compliment, actually. I'd be like, yeah.
Yeah, and like the kind of strange genre-bending stuff he's gone on to write then, like, really, I think he gets it. But so, I mean, I get that as well. And I understand that from the writers I was editing. But it did mean that I ended up maybe, you know, some of these pieces went through so many different kind of manifestations. They were several different essays along the way until they became what they eventually ended up as.
It was really cool, I remember, because one of the things I really appreciated and continue to appreciate about you, Roisin, is like, you have just such an interesting way of accepting ideas and working with ideas and stuff. So I was really excited because when you were coming to me telling me like, oh, here's what's in the pitches, like, I knew what you were going to select would be like really kind of cool, swervy kind of stuff. And that's what we got with the nonfiction. I was just delighted with
it. I love that. Swervy is the best word ever.
Yeah, that's what you want.
Yeah, no, it had to be weird. I remember early on when we had that first meeting, all I could talk about was Day of the Triffids. I just kept linking and like... Lisa and Declan were talking about, you know, like actual sincere climate stuff. And I just kept bringing up Triffids, like destroying London and like, yeah. So, I mean, to me, climate writing is sci-fi writing.
Yes.
That's where I encounter that. So I was kind of like, how can I bring this into nonfiction? We need this.
I think because otherwise what you would end up, and this is the difference, I think, between journalism and technical writing and policy writing and creative writing, is otherwise you would have gotten a situation where you had a load of stuff just telling us where we are now. And in terms of like, what does creative writing do or what place does it have in this conversation? It's certainly not like restating the facts. We have brilliant journalists who do that for us. We have policy that does that for us. We don't need to do that. It is bringing it into the space of imagination.
Yeah. And demonstrating the power of imagination in the face of this thing that actually challenges the imagination to get a grip on, like that term hyper-object, which I'm not all that familiar with anyway. But I mean, I do think it's an interesting way of approaching the theme. There were loads of pitches by really qualified people, like really impressive technically by, you know, climate scientists and journalists and people working for NGOs. And I mean, it's not to discredit them. They were really interesting. But I actually kind of didn't want the thing that you would expect. I didn't want writing on how worried we all are.
Because we know that, like, that's why we put together the issue in the first place, because it's speaking to a communal worry that people have. So, like, bringing them writing that says, aren't we worried? Mm. It's not going to do anything, is it?
Yeah, it just leaves us back where we are, worried.
Yeah. Here we are. Which we are.
Right now,
we're very worried.
Definitely. Roisin, can you talk about maybe one or two of these essays, like what the pitch was and how you worked with the writer? And
yeah, if I can go through them very, very quickly. They're super diverse. So I'm just reading them off the back here. But so Alice Capel, who I first learned about via YouTube, she's a French writer and a YouTuber who makes videos in English, though. And she's brilliant, talks a lot about politics and kind of culture. But she wrote about revisiting her hometown, which was it the town next door to where she's from? It's from the region of France she's from. And it was a sort of test bed for climate policies, really experimental, interesting climate policies. It's an old coal mining town, but it's also sadly kind of fallen to the far right in more recent years. So there's this kind of conflicted legacy there. Claire Carroll went out to visit a man who's keeping an archive of plastic bottles out on an island off, is it Scotland?
No, it's Guernsey.
Guernsey. Yeah. Where is Guernsey geographically? It's up north somewhere?
It's between like England and France. It's on the Channel Islands.
Oh, Channel Islands. That's it. I'm so bad.
Beside Jersey.
I'm so bad with geography.
I'm not very good at UK geography.
Yeah,
I don't know where things are in the UK.
This.
You don't think know where things are in Dublin.
But the island situation gets...
Excuse me.
Oh,
I know where things are in Mullingar.
In the podcast. You do. The Midlands are up and coming.
The island situation gets... Look, when The Outrun came out, I wrote about that and I couldn't tell all the islands apart off England and I was writing about it. Mia Gallagher wrote about grief and cycling. It's a lovely essay. It's like very personal,
it's
but it's also very much about kind of metabolizing feelings of like conflicted feelings, you know, of both hope and nihilism and, and doom and despair, but then also actual action, like little actions in your everyday lives. I think it's something that will strike, like it'll hit home with a lot of readers actually. If you're a cyclist, read this. Ella Gaynor wrote about travel and bins.
Yeah.
Cool essay. Really, cool essay, as with everything Ella writes, full of personality. And a fun one, very readable. Gus Mitchell, weird, fulfilling the weird quotient. I am so happy that this turned out the
this
way
this essay is so cool.
Oh, it's so cool.
And it was it's completely uneditable.
Yeah.
So you just have to go with it. Where Gus is going, you know, you follow him.
Brave new territory. Yeah, editing it was extremely daunting. It's called Oil Story and it's kind of midway between a poem. It's very Thomas Pynchon. At one point we had a phone call and we just ended up chatting for about an hour about our mutual obsession with Thomas Pynchon. And it's about oil, but every sentence gets longer by one word. So it's a spread, Lovecraftian spread of horror.
I think that's brilliant. Like it really is tentacled.
Yes.
I love it.
Tentacular thinking. Yeah, and the last two, Peter Murphy wrote about the song Supernature and the lyrics, which are in fact Lovecraftian too and are eco-horror. It's such a banger of an essay. And Philip O'Kelly made the sort of counterpoint around like catastrophizing, basically, around rhetoric around climate change, but also brought in all of this talk about where he lives and the history of Europe and... Just it's kind of like written in several points, but it's an interesting one. It kind of throws a spanner in the works, kind of. Yeah,
the little dissenting voice. I think you do.
Yeah, he is. He's the
Do kind of need.
Do you use the word personality there, and do you think that's important in an essay?
Yeah, I think when you write about something that we all are to some degree aware of, it's like whenever someone writes about the big epic themes, like I find when people write about, say, death or birth, you know, these kind of things that are as universal as it can get kind of for nonfiction, it's a real test of a writer because it can kind of flatten you into just a kind of speaking in cliches. And some of the most interesting writing, I think, kind of preempts those cliches and then, you know, kind of takes off into something entirely different. I don't know, does that make sense?
Definitely. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
But yeah, so climate, I mean, we kind of all, I suspect we all feel the same.
Yeah.
If you don't, what's going on? Where are you getting your news from?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Well, that's an entirely different podcast.
And tell me, when you were, so you worked on several drafts with each writer.
So initially commissioned them on pitches. And then they came back and some of them changed so dramatically over probably about 3 months of editing. So they kind of went through various iterations and were dramatically different.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I find that like, you know, as people that teach, one thing that you are always trying to like clear to your students is like the idea that something will change. Like, you know, it's going to transform it and you have to be open to the possibility of that. You cannot go in like being really rigid about your ideas.
No, and wherever you start, it's not going to be the place that the finished product starts.
You're always
going to rewrite the start. I say this to them all the time. So I think the fact that they came in as pitches as well kind of made it probably a more hands-on process for you, Roisin, that you were kind of able to go in and advise and kind of help the swerve. Maybe not. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, everyone had their own way of working. It's so interesting. It's only now since I left and I'm kind of reflecting back on the editing that I realize every editor probably learns to edit from their own edits.
Yeah,
maybe. I guess there are some editors who've never been writers.
There are.
Yeah. How does that work?
I find that really interesting as well.
I know.
Yeah.
I
think
they just know their limitations. Mm.
But so then everyone is bringing their own version of editing to the table. And then it's also kind of spontaneous and like symbiotic and depends on the person you're working with. Yeah. So like for Gus, I mean, he would just send me a few lines once in a while. Yeah. And just check in and be like, do you think this is okay? And I didn't really have that much to say because I was like, well, I need to see the whole thing. But of course, by the time the whole thing is written, editing is going to be very, very hard.
Yeah.
You'd almost need some sort of algorithm to like tell you how to edit it, to trim little words off and flag the sentences, because he must have been doing so much counting.
Yeah.
Word check.
That was like when I first got it, that was the first thing I started doing. Instead of, you know, your traditional line edit, because the lines themselves are formatted in such a way that you can't kind of bring your usual rules to them. So the first thing I started to do was counting the words to make sure that they were all like progressing in the sequence that he wanted. And like that was just like, I've never done anything like that before. You know?
It's mind-bending. I wonder if people who edit poetry have to think more about that, about the technical and formatting details.
100%, because it's all about rhythm and it's all about spacing, and it's a way more visual kind of way of presenting writing, isn't it? Poetry.
And in any of these essays, do you feel like the writer was like playing with like form, like, you know, in order to reflect what climate change feels like, or was it more just in the content?
Ooh. I think every single one of these essays touches on familiar feelings of kind of conflict, futility, fleeting senses of desperation. You know, all of that comes in. And then, like, even it's funny, you know, I kind of feel like there's a spectrum, say, with like Philip questioning so many narratives on one side of that spectrum, and like Mia kind of constantly talking about her guilt, kind of, you know, in throughout her essay, she weaves that in. And then at the same time, both of them meet at the middle at various points, because both of them entertain doubt, both of them entertain just they want to, you know, they're both really good writers, so they're both actually capturing the complexity of living in times like these, you know. In terms of, wait, what was the question again?
Like in terms of form.
In form, I mean, Gus, obviously.
Yeah.
This piece just breaks every, I don't know if it even acknowledged those rules to break them. I think he's working on his own frequency. In terms of, I mean, there's some quite classical essays in there. Like Peter's essay is quite straightforwardly, it's almost a piece of music criticism with eco horror. But it's about such a fascinating subject. It doesn't feel traditional at all.
Yeah, because it's so full of references, and it's almost like taking a trip through like eco art in the second half of the 20th century. There's so much in there that if he had played around with how it looked on the page as well, we would have lost something.
Yeah, it would be too much.
Yeah.
I mean, and I guess like with Mia's one and Ella's one, they're both personal essays that then touch on the theme. In Ella's one, you have this sense of climate catastrophe sort of invading from around the edges. She's moving into this place in Galway, and the first thing she sees is these sandbags stacked up outside the house. And then it turns out not only that obviously there's a flood coming, but there aren't enough sandbags. There will never be enough sandbags. I don't know. They're not... Yeah, they're swervy in their subject matter, in their voices. One is explicitly very experimental. But in terms of form, they're not that unusual. They're more just really lovely and polished.
Yeah. Can I ask you both, like, something I've been thinking about, and obviously there's been novels about it recently, but do you think contemporary writing and literature is rising to meet the climate catastrophe, or do you think it's something that we're still, like, shying away from a little bit? Or
I don't know if it's rising to meet it in the sense of, because that feels very deliberate. I think it's there because I think it can't but be there.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody is in some way engaging with it, whether or not they mean to. I think I'm kind of seeing, and I see it particularly like with the Stinging Fly, with the open submissions that we get, and a lot of the stories that are coming in, a lot of the essays that are coming in, a lot of the poetry that is coming in. It already is engaging with this. This is where people's heads are right now. So I don't think it's necessarily... But then I don't know, do you want a piece of writing that where somebody has sat down and said, I am going to meet the challenge of the climate crisis?
I know, that's like, what I...
Then does that then become kind of didactic? Yeah. And, you know, is that what we want? So I don't know. What do you think, Roisin?
God, My brain's going off in a million different directions right now.
I told you she's great that
the
way.
Brain octopus.
the tentacular
that's
thinking.
That's the first time that's happened on the podcast.
Brain octopus is going out. Because no, like basically, oh God. I mean, I'm thinking so much these days about, there's this weird fixation on evolution and like evolutionary psychology on the internet. Mm-hmm. And there's so much of like the kind of culture war and the far right and all this stuff talks about what nature is. Like they're trying to lay claim to what is natural and what mm-hmm. is right. And mm-hmm. I just keep wondering, I mean, in my first book, I talked a lot about like, is there even a nature to go back to? Yeah. Like, what is evolution in real time? You know, when you're not looking back over centuries, what does it mean like to live in modernity right now? And I think my favorite writing that responds to climate crisis is like stuff like Jeff Vandermeer. Mm. I've been thinking a lot this week about Danny Denton's book.
Yeah.
Oh, about the eternal rain. I was thinking about that this morning.
Yes. Yeah.
Coming up on the bus. And I was thinking, like, I remember, so this is The Early King and the Kid in Yellow.
Yeah.
And when I first read it, I was like going, wow, what speculative fiction. And now it's like, well, I'm going to have to buy oil skins like everybody in that novel does.
Oh, we're there. We're already there. Mm. No shoes can withstand
that,
it. Yeah, no, we are absolutely
ahead of his time.
He was the harbinger. Yeah. Mm. But it's interesting because a lot of that writing, like on the more sort of sci-fi end of things, I suppose, it really drives home to you how strange nature is, how it's this unknowable thing. Like I've been watching videos of this guy I follow on Instagram. He's in New York and like New York is just frozen over and it's like it's affecting their infrastructure. There are things that no amount of modernity can prepare for. It's just next thing everything's broken, you know, or like last night they shut down the DART line in Hoth because the flooding, you know.
And the headlines from Portugal as well though.
The climate emergency
and the sense that there is no infrastructure there that was able to, like when that infrastructure was planned, it wasn't in the state of predicting what we're living through now.
Yeah.
And I mean, I just think, this is pure like waffle. I'm so sorry. I'm going off in all directions. But I think about like when I look at the cat Sooty, who I'm taking care of right now. She's this beautiful little black cat.
Everybody likes an anecdote about a cat. It's
I love her so
always
much.
Always welcome.
And she's the reason my hands are covered in scratches and Rob's face is now covered in scratches. But I just look at her and there's such mystery about her. She's so unknowable. Animals are just so mysterious to me, even though we've shared the planet with them all this time. And cats have apparently officially bonded to us as humans. They are still so foreign and mysterious to us. And we've no idea, like, the consciousness of other creatures. And that's a domesticated cat.
Mm.
Like, wild nature, that phrase, think about it, you know, I mean, how estranged are we from the world? And at the very moment that we're going to have to know and anticipate nature's revenge upon us, we will also be the most estranged from it we have ever been. It's really strange.
So just last weekend I was talking about with my partner, can a dog understand a film?
Oh my God. I've watched videos of dogs watching films.
Yeah.
And there are apparently they see it as like stop motion.
Okay. See, that's what I mean. You don't know anything about their, or Lisa actually might have the answer to
I
this.
Do have, well, no, I don't. Yeah. Very specific. I was watching the other night a horror film on Shudder called Good Boy.
Mm. I've seen Good Boy!
Yeah, so it's a horror film from the point of view of the dog. Mm-hmm. And so my dog was on the couch beside me watching this film and she was very alert the entire time. But she wasn't agitated. She was just like, what the hell is going on the screen? So I don't know if this helps. And dogs,
that's so beautiful.
I didn't ask her how she felt about it. What would she give it out of 10? Yeah. I don't know.
You should send the director a letter. Like, tell him. It's his dog in the film. And it took him years to get that thing made.
I did 3 years, I think.
Oh, it's such a labor of love. I love it so much.
The dog is very cute. We should do a whole issue with film writing from dogs.
From dogs. My dog is good at this. I feel like I could help her.
But it's interesting, like speaking of that, I was thinking of like when I was growing up and stuff, there were all these kind of, you know, dramatic end of world films. Like I'm thinking of something like Deep Impact or like
the apocalyptic
of the
90s.
Yeah. And like the wave was going to come or like the city was going to be frozen over. And now these images, like, they look like what, and that those films aren't really made anymore, but these images like look like what we see all
the
time.
What we need is to send Bruce Willis up to drill into that asteroid. He will save us.
I mean, yeah.
And Ben Affleck, I don't.
To a lesser extent.
He'll offer moral support.
Lisa, on the fiction side, can you tell me what it was like to all the submissions for this issue?
Oh God! So because it was restricted by theme, the issue or the kind of submissions that were coming in, there were fewer of them. Mm. which is the first thing, but not by that much. Mm. So there was a huge amount of reading, and I did all the reading with the help of our contributing editors for this. Mm. And there was, it was kind of blurring towards the end because there was an awful lot of, for example, flood stories. Yeah. So you can tell that people are very worried about floods.
Yeah.
For good reason, as we have since found out. So there were a lot of that, and, you know, it was then trying to kind of, because to a degree, because so much of the submissions were concerned about very specific things like flooding, rain, it was kind of easy to see the stuff that was really spectacular kind of rising up through it. But there was so much. And this is one of the things I'm kind of finding it hard to deal with as editor of The Stinging Fly. There is so much good stuff out there.
Yeah,
there
that's
is
such a good
so
thing,
much. It's like, I think a lot of people think that if you're reading work for The Stinging Fly, that like 99% of it will be bad and then you just have to pick the 1%. But that's not the case at all. There is so much spectacularly good stuff, so much, and beneath that, so much promising stuff. And then you can't get to publish at all. So it does become an act of like curation rather than kind of selection in that sense. So you're kind of like going, where, you know, what kind of story is this? What does this speak to? Well, who hasn't done that? You know, what else is out there and stuff? So you try to get as wide a spread as possible. So one of the things I kind of knew is that I wanted, for example, for this, an island story. Mm. And I know Ireland is an island, but one of the islands that are on the forefront of kind of the climate crisis. So we got Ariel Saramandi, who's from Mauritius, who wrote a story for us about that. Then I wanted something that was going to be either from a writer who is from Brazil or otherwise engaged with the Amazon. Mm. And then James Young, who's a brilliant translator that we've worked with before and who's also a brilliant writer that we've published before. He brought in a piece from Yoka Renner's Teron that was based in and around. It was from Death and the Meteor, which is a novel that was published, I think, 2019. So this is the first kind of English translation that has appeared to that. And that's kind of engaged with the Amazon. So we got stuff like that. And then everything else is like this. Some, oh, man, I could go on about all the lovely stuff in here. But we got, I think, a lovely mix of stuff that is concerned with the horrors.
Yeah, the horrors.
Climate.
They never stop. And can you talk about a few of the stories in the issue?
Oh, you see, this is hard because unlike Roisin, I don't have a small selection to kind of go. Mm. I can speak about each of these. But I don't want to kind of play favourites. We got some, like, we've some lovely Irish things in here. We've Leah Dooney Quinn kind of starts the issue. She has this lovely, and anybody who's read Leah Dooney knows their style is just this lovely, hazy kind of like, really, I don't think anybody writes quite like Leah Dooney, actually. Mm. It's really fascinating. So they've written this really speculative, hazy, dreamlike story, but is imbued with hope and kind of sweetness and love. And I wanted that to kind of start the issue. I wanted something like that. And I feel like when you're putting the issue together, it's a lot of it is to do with what piece speaks to what poem, what essay, you know, where are the echoes and how do we pick things up? And I know that it's funny because, like, I think a lot of people pick up something like The Stinging Fly and just read the things that they're interested in first. But I put a lot of thought into how it should unfold. But I was just thinking Leiden's piece is just, it stands alone and it should be first. So we moved through and we got some, like, we've got June Caldwell is in there with a brilliant story that's kind of based, no spoilers, but very much takes inspiration from The Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
I thought that one.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. There you go. We got Gavin Corbett, another brilliant Irish writer who's in there with like one of his spectacular Gavin stories. Just an absolutely fantastic kind of piece. And we got some of the newer writers as well. Rosemary Geary is in there. Just a fantastic emerging writer with the most beautiful turn of phrase. And like going through, I knew that. So the last story is kind of special. I mean, all the stories are special. All the stories have special bits. But the last one is quite special because I remember reading it in the submissions by Freddie McKee, who's a young British writer, called Her Father Had a Bonsai Tree. And I read this story and it was echoing in my head even as I read it in the submissions. This is the ending story. This is the last story. But it's a strange thing because I opened up with kind of love and light from Leiden. And Freddie's ends in such a note of ambiguity and such a note of kind of, we're thinking, actually, can we do anything? Mm. I don't know. So it's quite downbeat in a very beautiful way. And I think that feels more realistic, a note to end on, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's not, you're not going to end on a hugely positive note.
Yeah, it's all okay, guys.
Actually, you know, don't worry too much. I think it's going to go away.
Just keep your houses like heated at 21 degrees and throw away all your plastic bottles. It'll be fine.
Get a sad lamp, batten down the hatches.
Yeah.
And from reading for the nonfiction side and the fiction side, getting a general overview, what would you say that the like overwhelming feeling was, pessimism or like different feelings?
Oh God, yeah. I think so. I don't think there was anybody kind of, maybe you saw, I don't think there was anybody kind of writing in going like, it's absolutely fine, actually. I think, I can't wait till we all feel warm with our global warming. I don't think it was that at all. I think weirdly, the most optimistic piece in this is probably Philip's.
Yeah.
Actually,
to bring back, it's funny, like his and Mia's are both about just soldiering on.
Yeah.
They're very different, but in different, they're taking different approaches and thinking about it differently, but they're both quite practically minded, like just thinking, well, we're not all just going to die. That would probably be good for the planet, but we're not going to just stop existing as a species. So let's think about how to carry on.
Yeah, I think that is like a useful kind of way to think about it. One thing I think about when I think about climate change is like the loss of the seasons. Like,
yes.
I feel like whenever I watch a film or read about, and it's like autumn and it's like actually autumn, like from, you know, however many, there's the leaves and whatever. Yeah. I'm like, we don't get the
autumn
seasons.
Just exists as a Pinterest board now. That's like, all it is.
It's only for the Mormon girls.
It's just for the Mormon girls with their
the
Starbucks.
With spice lattes. That's it.
But I think that loss of all the seasons, everything just becoming one big...
wet.
Yeah.
It makes me really angry as a spring child. My birthday's in spring. And every day this last week I've been like, spring, where are you? You failed me.
Yeah.
What's going on?
I think we're going to get spring back, Roisin. We're going to get it back for you.
Will we ever wear trench coats again?
I'm actually wearing one now. I don't understand the weather. my mother is right when she tells me there's to wear better clothes. Did you have any other kind of observations from going through all the stories, Lisa?
I would love to say that I have some sort of succinct piece of wisdom for people. I don't. Yeah. And I think that that's because that kind of speaks to the diversity of voice and the diversity of kind of approach that we got. There's nothing to be kind of like easily gleaned from something like this. And I think that's probably the way it should be, you know.
I have this, I was thinking about this recently, you know, that like, and you write so wonderfully about this kind of stuff, Roisin, but like the focus on the individual, like the self-improvement and like the how far it's all going now. Like I think I saw some girl on Substack, she had a piece recently. It was like, I've already been to see my facialist like 5 times and it's only February, and you know, she's on like Ozempic and all this, like this absolute like obsession with the body and the self. It's like, because it's just controllable.
Yeah.
It's just like one thing when everything else, the world, the weather is like and chaotic around you. It's just like, and it's going to, I think it's going to keep getting worse, like more and more inwards.
I'm glad you said that actually, because that has reminded me, one of the other brilliant pieces that kind of, it kind of falls, I suppose, under nonfiction, because it's our climate roundtable that we have in this issue too. So we got, people who are kind of very knowledgeable on climate to come together and have a chat about it. So we have an academic in Dr. Nessa Cronin. We have a social entrepreneur in Catherine Cleary. We have an activist in Saoirse Exton. We have a journalist and writer in Padraig Fogarty. And then we have a farmer in Kenneth Keevy. And we got them all together and kind of talked about that. And one of the things that I was just really pleased to read coming from this, like all these very knowledgeable people, is the kind of the acknowledgement that actually as an individual facing this, there's not an awful lot you can do.
Yeah.
You know, you can't go up there and go, well, you know, I very carefully wiped out my kind of disposable packaging and I recycled it and I didn't buy my disposable cup of coffee. And now the climate is fixed.
I know, yeah.
And that's, I mean, the acknowledgement that actually, do you know what? There's not a huge amount you can do. You can do things like you can vote the right way.
Yeah, yeah.
You can apply pressure in the way that you can in a democracy, but don't kind of beat yourself up or don't curtail your life and your enjoyment of living because of climate anxiety.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to what you were saying, Nicole, in terms of like when everything around you feels chaotic, then you start trying to figure out what you can control and you can really get carried away with that.
Really. Yeah.
It's a response also to, I think, surveillance, which it goes hand in hand with the kind of political parties that
It's all connected,
advance climate change, basically, that want to ruin the climate. Yeah.
And power surveillance, because there's an awful lot of energy needed to do that amount of surveillance.
Yeah, like self-care that's born out of more out of fear than out of self-love.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Something really fascinates me.
I do think fear is the exact kind of word what I encounter now. I feel like there is this like it's almost like someone is like trembling writing it about their like routines or whatever. Oh, yeah. It is so like a almost layer of insanity to it, like, you
also,
know.
So not to bring my own we have to, I think everyone needs to vote thinking about the future, the thing that we cannot avoid, instead of voting based on an illusion of the past, of a return to the past. I'm bringing my own petty grudgery to this show today.
Good.
There's a story in the news.
I tell everyone to.
I prepared so many.
Yeah.
There's a story in the news
today.
Going
extra, Lisa has a whole list on her there.
let's read a list of grudges. No, but they're settling in court the legal definition of a sausage. So all of the vegetarian like meat substitute manufacturers are petitioning against this, obviously. The same happened with milk, oat milk. And
it's an oat-based drink.
Yeah, an oat-based drink. Soylent. It just sounds so much more suspicious when it's called an oat-based drink. But like, and the meat and dairy lobbies are obviously pushing to protect this definition. And it makes me so angry. I don't normally take out my vegetarian axe to grind. Like, I've not eaten meat since I was like 11 years old. But it just makes me so angry that these enormous changes, like we're not even vegan fascist here, guys. Like, we're not trying to tell everyone to take away their meat. Like, it's just let them have the chance to buy a nice tofu sausage or a seitan sausage. And instead they're just fighting every little change they can.
And this is it. Like, and you, in order to properly combat what's happening, you need to make huge, like, radical changes. Yeah. And instead it's like, no, we're going to court to argue over the definition of a sausage.
The meat one is such a, it annoys me so much because, like, it's such a contributor to carbon emissions and other climate change too. And, like, fish, you know, is, like, stripping the sea of its, like, nutrients and all the rest. But it's not, I'm not claiming everyone should stop eating meat, but just, like, give it a chance a few days a week. Just eat a bit less and everyone will be better off, you know.
It's good for fiber as well to be eating more vegetables.
Yeah.
It is.
Just saying.
I recommend seitan.
You recommend Satan?
Yeah. The Dark Lord of vegetarian.
Okay, now you're going too far.
Of meat substitutes. No, seitan is amazing. Yeah.
Start playing the podcast backwards.
For Lisa's list of petty grudges. No.
It is sort of in, like, that is the thing where I was saying, like, if it feels outside your control, because I do feel like even now, you know, in Ireland, you're reading about like the nonstop kind of building of data centers and things.
Yeah. Oh my God.
And
what
that
is
something
going on?
That you feel you have apart from like petitioning or voting, you have no control over that.
Like, we just went through a phase of cryptocurrencies. What was that for? What did that achieve?
Yeah.
And that was so data intensive. And now we're just turning everything into AI.
Yeah.
In our last election, we decimated the Green Party.
I know.
We did more than decimate. We, eradicated.
Yeah, yeah.
And now we're going, oh God, it's terrible. The climate has come to get us. Well, I'm not saying that voting in the Green Party would have stopped it. It wouldn't, but like...
It does
feel
like a particularly wasteful moment. Like, I feel like, you know, you're saying about AI, where we're generating all and using all this electricity to make, like, just terrible, like... like disorientating, like deranging images, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, so note of hope. So myself and Roisin lecture at the University of Galway, and we are kind of seeing, particularly now our students are creative writing students.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously they are the sensitive artsy types anyway, but we are seeing more and more them turning away from screens and going back to analog and handwriting. And like, if you mention AI, even as part of a conversation. Like, they get very angry.
Yeah, right. Mine did too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised by that. And I think also because they're a generation that's much more aware of their own, like the word mental health has been watered down to the point of meaninglessness, but they actually are much more tuned in to their own emotional states and to even just how they work. They're like, it's probably the self-optimizing thing, but also they know that this stuff has an effect on them and that they can counteract it. With simple reality.
But also they grew up in a way that we didn't with the climate change conversation.
Yeah, there was no kind of sense of novelty either for them for internet or screens.
No.
They're the digital natives, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah.
Are they actually rejecting them outright? They're just being like, no, I don't want...
I know, they still have their laptops and stuff, but like they're not...
They look down on AI, definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I found that when we were kind of discussing AI here at the Stinging Fly and thinking about like how we should respond to this and what people wanted from us, I think one of the things that we thought first is that we were going to have to make a big statement asking people not to use this to send us work. And actually what we found is that there are a lot of people who instead want reassurances from us that we are not going to resort to using AI to read submissions or, you know.
Were you accused of that?
No, not accused. I just think that people are more worried. Like, so the worry about AI, everybody seems to be worried about the next person adopting it rather than realizing that actually a huge amount of people don't want this at all.
Yeah.
And it has been forced on us because there has been so much invested in it in terms of like these billionaires that are running the place. And they're like, no, no, no. I mean, you can't even open your email now. You get a little pop-up going, would you like me to read your email for you? I'm no, I wouldn't. I'm very good at reading.
Yeah.
I can do that. Yeah.
And then I don't read it.
Yeah, maybe it was designed for you, Nicole.
Possibly.
I'll read your emails for you. I don't want you resorting to AI.
Can I ask, did you get any submissions that were like climate denial? Was there any kind of argument of, did someone be like, actually, you know?
Well, actually.
Yeah.
I don't think I came across anything like that in the fiction. I really don't. I don't think so.
No, nothing outright anyway.
I don't, I'm not sure that the patience would have been there from our end anyway. You know, if you're having a special climate issue and you've written like, we want people to respond to climate, and somebody written in and gone, I think it's actually fine. Where is the creativity in that? Where are you going to get, what are you going to get out of that? That's rubbish.
Yeah, can I ask also, what do you think, because like the Stingfly doesn't do many themed issues. Like I know this, we've done there's a Galway issue.
There was a Galway issue.
Yeah.
There's been a London issue, but they don't.
We had all new writers a few years ago, which was great.
But you don't do many themed issues. And what do you think is like the kind of value behind doing the occasional one?
I think when there's something like this that we are seeing popping up in people's writing and becoming quite common to everyone's writing, then it feels like a good idea to allow people space to really engage with it. So I think something like that, I think I think a lot of it is like giving writers the permission in a sense to kind of say, yeah, actually put this thing that is clearly already in your work, put it at the forefront, spend time on it, respond to it, write to it. We want to read it. I think it just felt like the right time in that sense.
It's a lovely creative prompt.
Yeah,
it is.
It's also a test of a writer, like to avoid cliches. But it's a very interesting prompt because it's quite specific and yet extremely broad.
Yeah. There's so many different ways into it, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, different approaches, different focuses.
Mm. And Roisin, was this your last issue?
Yeah, it is.
The climate broke Roisin.
Yeah. I was washed away in the tides.
But Danny Denton's
I'm back now. I quit after this issue.
Yeah.
It's been really lovely.
Yeah.
I've learned so much as well. It's just been actually this invaluable education in how to work with words. Like I say that almost like words are this weird sentient entity that has to be like,
they kind of are magic.
Like a cat. You have to kind of you can't really domesticate them. You can only really work with them. And no, it's been so cool as an experience. And I think it's been very good for me as a writer too, actually. But between editing and teaching, it has been the most fascinating period of it. Like, because I was reading before, it's about officially a year as nonfiction editor. And then before that, I was reading a bit as well for a few, probably for about a year, was it? Yeah. So it's been this really interesting multi-dimensional experience of just living in writing all day, all the time. I think where I'm kind of, I feel like I've spent too much time with the essay. So that now I'm kind of, I'm trying to build up other parts of writing for myself and we'll see what happens.
And what's next?
I'm writing kind of half fictions, half non-fictions. Actually, something I wrote last month is kind of climatey. It's about a man who, and I don't know what's going to happen to it, but it's a real life story, but I wrote it as kind of semi-fiction, about a man in Montana who bred a cloned hybrid super sheep. 82-year-old man, and he got sent to prison for it.
He did it all on time.
He imported like the DNA of this giant sheep. It's like this giant. Its horns are as wide as a piano. It's this mutant. Like, it was in the news headlines, it was called a mutant.
Is there pictures of it?
Yeah, and it now lives in a zoo. It got confiscated by the feds and taken away. But I got really fascinated by that theme of just, like, man, like, warping nature. You know, like, someone who believes he's really close to nature. He loves this sheep, but it's actually Frankenstein's sheep. I got really obsessed
Frankenstein's sheep. I would watch that.
I get really obsessed with like people with strange life missions, like the Unabomber. There's eco icon.
Yeah,
like,
he was right.
He got it done. Wasn't good what he got done.
No, but he had some good points in that manifesto.
There were some points.
Yeah.
It's a shame about the rest of it.
Yeah. Shame about what happened after.
I don't even know how to respond to that. I'd just like to say we are not pro the Unabomber.
No.
We're not.
Just only categorically.
We're not an anti-him either.
No one's advocating building bombs out of wood and sending them.
He just
them.
Wanted some time to himself as well.
Peace and quiet.
Peace and quiet. Yeah. And Lisa, the next issue of The Fly is out when? And you're reading for that at the moment.
I'm reading for that at the moment. That will be out in May. And that, like, again, so because we're opening, or because the submissions were open again, because it wasn't restricted to a theme, there was just a deluge of amazing stuff that's coming in. So I'm actually tearing my hair out over it right now.
And how has your, that's such a positive thing to say though, that the submissions are like more there than they are not, you know? That's,
it is. It's very humbling, actually, as a writer, to see the amount of talent that's out there. It is really, and the level of talent and the level of imagination, it really is. It's kind of like, it's exhausting as an editor, but it's also really invigorating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's kind of, it's fab.
It's fab.
I just feel like I really should mention the poetry.
Of course.
In this issue. Obviously Anne-Marie Negron is our poetry editor, so she did all the selections, but I would just like to say she made some spectacular choices. It was a real pleasure to kind of fit all of this really wonderful stuff, because I think the poetry is at the forefront of this kind of like immediate response to huge issues. Poetry is like a really almost like perfectly suited to it. And there's some fabulous bits in here. It was just to be able to kind of like compose this issue from the selections she had, and just to see the breadth of responses from the poets. We love the poets.
We do.
And I just wanted to say as well, just because I mentioned every story apart from two stories or three stories, and I want to say them really quickly because I just feel really bad that I didn't. So we have Louisa Owen has a wonderful story called The Man in the Mass, which is absolutely, has to be read to be believed because it is deceptively bonkers, really quite weird. Nandini Rawat has written a brilliant story about like heat in India. Really, really frightening story. And John Saul has a beautiful piece called Dresden and a story about kind of things that are permanent in a world where everything is thrown away. So I just wanted to mention those.
Lovely. All great stories. And because we have a little bit of time, I think I'm just going to... Roshan, you have a book coming out this year, don't you?
I do. It's coming out in August.
It's like great. You just remembered it there. You were like, oh God.
It's happening. It's, yeah, well, I mean, I was going to say it's real. It will be real. Mm. I,
Just like climate change.
I believe.
Oh my God.
It will be. Yes.
It's real.
It's real. Believe it. Yeah. Yeah, my book is coming out in August, at the end of August, with Tramp Press. And it's called The Most Normal Woman, Essays on Appearances. It's interesting you bring up earlier, like, these little things we do every day to control our response to the big, scary, lurching things that hang over us. Because that's kind of the theme of the book. Mm. It's about how we put a face on ourselves to meet the world. Mm. And what does that do on a kind of deeper level?
That sounds so great, Roisin. I can't wait to read that. Thank you, Lisa and Roisin. It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for listening to the Stinging Fly podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it. Or if you're new to the podcast, please subscribe. You can support the work we do by taking out a subscription to the Stinging Fly magazine or by becoming a friend of the fly. Information, all our workshops, events and publications can be found on stingingfly.org. This episode of the Stinging Fly podcast was hosted by me, Nicole Flattery, produced by Owen Rogers and edited by Ian Mullaney. Thanks to the Arts Council who provide funding for this podcast and for everything else that the Stinging Fly is doing to seek out, nurture, publish and promote the very best new writers and new writing. We'll be back next month. Thanks again for listening.